Welcome to the Chariot Solutions TechCast. I'm producer Becca Rufford. In this episode, our host Ken Rimple talks to two of our consultants here at Chariot, Drew DeCarme and Matt Gilbride. They reflect on the technologies and techniques they use to stand up a Docker-based web application on AWS. The project was organized using a Lerna-based Mono repo to share code across multiple React frontends and the Node Express backend. Part of the discussion involves how the team used React and styled components to handle reusable, responsive design elements. The TechCast is brought to you by Chariot Solutions. Chariot Solutions is a greater Philadelphia area-based software design and development consultancy. For over 17 years, companies of all sizes and industries have looked to Chariot as a partner to help them solve their toughest software challenges. Our years of experience guiding clients through hundreds of complex projects has shaped our methodology. A simple philosophy guides our process, working in lean teams of remarkably talented designers and engineers who treat the client's success as if it's their own will consistently yield exceptional results. You can visit us online at chariotsolutions.com. Now, on to TechCast number 117 with Matt Gilbride and Drew DeCarme.
My name is Ken Rimple. I work for Chariot Solutions. I'm the Director of Training and Education Services. And I wanted to get together with two people on a project we worked on together. Let me introduce two consultants at Chariot, Drew DeCarme and Matt Gilbride. They have worked with me on a project for 5 or 6 months last year that I'd love to talk about. So Drew and Matt, Drew, you first. Why don't you give a quick hello about who you are, your background?
Sure. So my name is Drew DeCarme. I've been doing front-end development for pretty much my entire career, probably upwards of 10 years now. I've done a lot of different projects, a lot of different scales. I primarily specialize in React, but you know, I've done work with Angular, I've done work with Vue, our beloved jQuery for the longest time, MVC frameworks. So my experience kind of extends primarily in front-end, but I do have a good amount of design experience. I've designed interfaces. I try to institute a lot of design thinking in taking design assets and moving them to actual code. Now these days, everything's an architecture problem. So I spent a lot of time really thinking about how designs can be better architected, especially in the overall code base.
Great. And Matt?
I started my career not in engineering at all, in various roles in kind of supply chain analysis and consulting, and then kind of came slowly from the back to the front. So I spent a number of years doing mostly, Spring, MVP, MVC, server-side REST stuff, database stuff, things like that. And then, kind of was very interested in single applications just because I had never really done any front-end dev work before. So I'd say 2.5 years ago, I kind of pivoted and started doing full-time React stuff like 90% of the time. And that's where I've been. So I'm the resident TypeScript enthusiast, I think, at Chariot now, although I've indoctrinated Drew onto my team, and very passionate about all things, coding, put it that way.
Awesome. So we worked together on this project. Drew came in probably about a month and a half in as we were starting more of the front end work. The project was, without mentioning the client name or too much of the details, it was a cloud-based project to control basically power switches and do it through kind of a scheduling tool that go in and turn on or off devices based on what their usage was. And they had an original application written in PHP that ran against some cloud resources in AWS. And when they brought the project to us, they needed to rewrite the front end and rewrite the platform to be able to scale for when they go to production. It was kind of their initial proof of concept. So overall, it was a cloud-based project with a web front end. That was the requirement. Web front end, cloud-based project to control some AWS-centered resources that then would control some basically IoT type devices in the field. So first of all, let's talk a little bit about overall how the project was structured. And I'm gonna lean on Drew Moore in the beginning here because Drew came into our project as we were working through things that we put together by hand with NPM, and he brought in Lerna. So let's just talk in general about kind of a mono repo project and like what that meant for us as development team.
So the entire stack, and Matt, I don't want to steal your thunder here, but the entire stack was JavaScript. It was a custom Express server. And then on the front end, we had React. Everything being JavaScript across the stack, it made a little bit more sense for us instead of having, separate repositories that had, one React application and another React application that didn't really have any awareness to each other, especially when using TypeScript. We brought in Lerna to kind of segment our JavaScript packages up a little bit more and release them independently. So we had a package for types, we had a package for a React application, we had a package for our Node server, and that allowed us to first have these packages rely on each other a little bit better. So learn to use symlinks and then hoist all of your Node dependencies up to the root. So it is possible to have multiple React applications using one version of React, and that's some of the problems that you get to experience with hooks. But there's a lot of really nice things that Lerna does for you as far as publishing, versioning, symlinking, and it just made a lot of sense because what we were doing is manually, you know, changing in directories, making build distribution directories, and then copying those directories over to another directory. Lerna kind of removed a lot of the bloat that we had initially kind of scaling up. And honestly, that's how tools like that are created. People realize that they need to do this in a little bit better way, in a way that's a little bit more scalable. And adding a couple commands at the root of our repository really scaled things up quickly, especially as it came to linting and especially as it came to testing too. So
right. So Ken and I started out, you know, in the kind of trying to be minimalist and not introduce, you know, lots of dependencies. And one good thing to note is that the client was a team of non-JavaScript developers. Now, they're all very capable engineers generally. I think most of them had kind of like a C#, like .NET background. So they actually wanted the server written in Node, which made sense because they wanted to eventually potentially easily run it as a Lambda as opposed to in an EC2 instance, which I don't know if they've done in the end of but they wanted essentially something that was pretty simple to convert to a Lambda, which, you know, when you write a Node Express server, you know, the shape of request responses between just a Node Express server and a Lambda are not that different. But we started, since, you know, really it's just a Node project and a React project, and then the shared bit of code was essentially shared type declarations and kind of validators, right? So we were attempting to share form validation and API validation in the same library. So there were essentially three principal libraries, and which is why we took the approach of like, hey, do we really need Lerna? And neither Ken nor I ever had any experience with a monorepo tool. So we said, you know, let's just write some shell scripts and things like that when we need to manage this. And that worked for a while. But when Drew came on and introduced Lerna, we realized that like, we got a whole lot of niceties for things that we were doing basically manually. And in the end, you know, somebody that already knew that tool well was able to convert it over. And, you know, I think it took you 2 weeks at that point, Drew, because we've been at it for maybe 6 weeks. And once we got there, now it is true. Like, you have a kind of better story about versioning and releasing your code across those three projects. And you have a much better story if like a fourth project comes along, right? So the web app, the React app that they've written is for like, you know, their basic web kind of client facing UI, but this company is hopefully going to grow, right? And they're going to want to write more applications. They might want to write a second Node server that does other things. They might want to write Lambdas that do specific things. And they have now a Lerna template that shows them how to kind of manage all those dependencies in one place across multiple projects.
So, yeah. You know, based on the fact that you were doing all the TypeScript and React development, talk a little bit about the structure of the projects then, the way the types were put together, the kinds of things you had to work with challenge-wise, maybe like how you're passing types in and out of things and validating and sending things up the stack. How'd you approach that?
This is something I'm a bit passionate about. The nice thing about TypeScript and the nice thing about Node and React is that you can share type declarations and code between client and server. So what we wanted to do was essentially for the domain-driven design part of this project, right? When we were defining domain entities, all of those entities existed in a single package that was shared by the client and the server. So when you say we're to post to create a foo, the type foo is an interface that's shared between the front end and the back end. So the form that's posting the foo has to create a valid foo and send it. And the post endpoint that is on the other side of that, which is a foo. And that's really nice. That's actually something that I have never been able to do in other stacks before. Some of the challenges, especially in Express, in the Node server, are that, you know, TypeScript is a static type checker, but everything is still JavaScript under the hood. So it's very important to understand that, like, when you accept a request in a REST API, TypeScript itself gives you no guarantees about what the shape of the request body or the request itself in its entirety is going to be. You still need to check it. So what we did is we used a library called Yup, which is very similar to a library called Joy, which is super popular. It's just a JavaScript object. It's a schema validator. It's a JavaScript schema validator. Mm-hmm. And what we did is we would basically inline. So we would have a type, and then the only thing that stinks is that you have duplicated code, right? So we'd have a TypeScript interface or type, And then right below it, we would have a YUP schema in that same project, right, so that forms could validate themselves by calling that same YUP schema. And then when the REST controller accepted a request, it would use the same YUP schema to validate that some type is actually type T. And we wrote a little abstraction called a REST controller factory, which essentially gives you a more strongly typed controller, which you don't really get in Express, right? Every request that comes in is of type any. And we would give, especially since the guys on the back end were like kind of C sharp guys. I kind of, you know, originally was a Java guy, actually ABAP way back in the day, which is kind of a COBOL type language. Like I wanted a way to express a very similar pattern where it's like, I accept a request of a certain structure and I send a response of a certain structure. Mm-hmm. And YUP combined with TypeScript was actually really nice to do that, right? Because now I'm able to write a controller that like has very well-defined inputs and outputs. And then the front end is able to share the code that I use to validate those inputs to send requests to that controller. So that was really cool. In hindsight, one neat thing that you can do that I realized is that instead of writing a type declaration and a schema, you could just write a YUP schema and then have your types be type of that schema, because YUP actually has pretty good type inference. So you actually hypothetically could eliminate some of that duplication. Now it's not going to be perfect, but it can get pretty close.
Now also, like, you know, so there we talked about the Express, React, and overall React structure. So that mono repo with Lerna really helped us have a lot easier time sharing those base libraries. That was like a huge deal for us when Drew was able to roll that out. Oh my God, that was huge. So let's talk a little bit about like the services and infrastructure, the quote unquote server side of this thing, right? We're running this thing on Docker instances in development. And then we're going to ultimately, when we deployed it, we put it on Docker on AWS, which is a service called ECS. So let's talk a little bit about that. So Matt, why don't you talk a bit about the server side infrastructure for the code? Like, how does the code hit an endpoint? What does it look like?
Yeah, so the motivation was to keep this thing dead simple at first, just because this is somewhat of a greenfield project, right? They don't have super massive scale that they need to deal with out of the gate. So, you know, and again, this remember, this client is super small at this point. So all it is it's just a node instance running in a Docker container. And in the context of AWS, it's running in ECS and Elastic Container Service. So there's a couple pieces of infrastructure. We were using Amazon's Cognito service for authentication, and we're using just their application load balancer to handle load balancing and managing traffic and DDoS prevention and things like that. But those are kind of the big boxes, and there's not that many. In fact, even the React app was actually just served by the Node application at the root. So the Node application just served those static assets. Now, if you want to get a little bit fancier, you know, normally you would serve something that like that out of an S3 bucket. But in our case, you know, we kind of started off like, let's just serve it this way. So there's just a single runnable piece of infrastructure that's serving everything. And then it's relatively simple to break something off and then like, okay, I'm going to serve React out of this S3 bucket and Node in the EC2 container later. And then from a local development perspective, everything was handled basically by Docker Compose, right? So I guess the other big, you know, box infrastructure-wise is a Postgres instance. So an AWS that ran against an RDS. Mm-hmm. And then locally, we just had a Docker Compose file that spun up a standard Postgres instance, spun up a Flyway runnable, which is how we handled database migrations, and then spun up the Node server and the React app all in containers. And that makes everything pretty simple, right? If you wanted to mimic something pretty close to how things were going to run on AWS on a local machine, Docker Compose up and you were good to go. So you could build that React Node application together and just run it against the database. The only piece that wasn't there, I guess, in local mode is the load balancer. But that's kind of that's a pretty plug and play solution from AWS. So that normally wasn't a problem.
Yeah, you know, we ended up using, if I remember correctly, M files that we didn't check in for like how we configured running Docker locally.
Right. So we had a couple environment files that would say, you could say, hey, I want to run the Node and the React app against the actual RDS instance in AWS against like kind of the non-production staging data, which was nice, right? That allows you to say, hey, let's get a bunch of data in the AWS infrastructure and then just point our development version of the UI at this data so we can make sure that things are working well when there's lots and lots of records coming through and things like that.
And I know we had we were using code build, for example, to do the build. So based on a commit and a particular branch, which I think was the dev branch, we merged it by default. Keith Gregory put together some nice scripts and shell scripts and a little bit of Python to deploy, to basically build that Express server with the embedded React app, take that, turn it into an Elastic container registry image, basically a Docker image, upload it to ECR, and then tap a bit to deploy it and update the containers in ECS, which was really a nice thing to work with.
Yeah, and one just very general, direction from Keith that I agree with and I think works really well is what we would do is we would build on a merge into development, but deploy was a manual step. So it was literally just a matter of pressing a button. But when we wanted to deploy to staging, it wouldn't just kind of happen without us knowing about it. We could commit code, push into dev, make sure that, that our CI was running and things were good. And then when we were ready to cut something to staging, it was a matter of just going into a code build spot and just, hitting build and pressing the button and like letting it go out. That gives you kind of a more intentional way, manner of actually deploying your code versus, building your code and running CI and making sure everything looks
great. Now, Drew, I'm going to pull back to you. Let's talk a bit about the UI side of things, right? So when we were engaged, we used some of our user experience people to work on kind of the high level and how things would flow. But then the rubber had to hit the road and we had to actually roll out some actual code to do the work. And you came with, as we would put it from a certain movie, a specific set of skills. And so those skills involved dealing with responsive design in React. So talk a little bit about the solution that you rolled out and how you made it so that the application behaved really well on screens and tablets.
Yeah, I mean, there's a total level to that question for sure. But
sure.
Essentially what happened is that we had our design team go out. They did a good amount of work with our customers as well as their users. Mm-hmm. They made some realizations, they made some assumptions, and then they put together an application design. The application design was pretty brand relevant. So colors, styles, spacings were all pretty well aligned to the actual brand of our client. So one of the things that we actually had to do was say, all right, how do we go about actually instituting this style? So, Matt and I kicked around a lot of different ideas. Should we use component libraries? Should we use CSS utilities? What's our fault tolerance here? How good does it need to be? Like they also had a time crunch too. So we had to evaluate a lot of our solutions against that. Mm-hmm. So what we eventually decided to do is use styled components. Styled components for me, especially being indoctrinated into the cult of TypeScript, worked really, really well. And it also made sense too, because we were providing familiar APIs or familiar methods of actually using your styles to JavaScript, which obviously our client needed a little bit more of a simple implementation. So styled components was fine, but we felt that we needed to harden our strategy a little bit more. We needed to make it a little bit more safe, a little bit easier to use. And obviously this is, I can go really deep on this, but I'm not going to. But if you do want to go deep on it, come to ET.
Yeah, come to ET, see their talk.
Yeah.
So wait, quick plug, let's do the quick plug. So you guys have been working really hard on a talk around React and style, right? Tell me a little bit about what you're talking about.
So our
talk, take a side note.
Yeah, quick aside. When Matt and I were trying to come up with make our styling solution a little bit harder, we realized that we had to make our own design system, or pretty much code our own design system. And we wanted to do it using type safety. So type safe design systems were born. And that's obviously the content of our presentation. It's a paradigm in which we break our design system down into parallels to language primitives. And we use typing and utilities to build up our... I won't give away everything, but we basically use those to build up utilities that can then institute a design system the way that you need to have it done in a completely type safe manner. So we use that strategy to build out utilities that handle color, that handle responsiveness, that handle size, that handle space and relation. And we actually instituted that in the React application. And I think after we developed the utilities, we first then went and developed our components. So we built our components and our React components in a completely different package, just a regular components package. And we use Learnit to manage that and link those components to those different projects. So if they did want to build another app, again, it wasn't a matter of copying and pasting components out of one directory into another. You had components that were sort of in their own isolated environment, They were using TypeSafe styles. And then from there, we were able to import those components and use, again, our TypeSafe utilities to make those components relate to each other. So
I think that's a good, quick point to expand on, right? So when we started before Learner and Thinking, we would have essentially three projects, right? A shared domain project where those schemas and type and kind of domain level types were defined, a React app and a Node app. And when we introduced Learner, we were able to say, hey, like, let's pull the components themselves and the design system out into their own projects so that they can be independently imported into other projects as the company grows, right? So now if they want to create another React app that serves a different purpose or, you know, something else entirely, maybe it's not even React, they can now consume those components as if they were regular NPM libraries, having to, like, you know, as something that I've seen in real life, like, I need to now go copy paste my button and my card and all those things into my new React project because I don't have a way to import them, right? So that's right. That's something that was really important, but now, like, it sets you up for future success.
And getting back to your original point, the aim of the application needed to actually be responsive, because after a couple of different conversations, we realized that we needed to have the application optimized first for iPad and then for screens going up. So it completely flips how you style applications on its head, because it's very, very difficult to go from a desktop down to a tablet by removing styles. What you really want to do is have an additive approach. So one of the main utilities that we built was a TypeSafe responsive utility that allowed us to be a little bit more semantic in our approach, saying, all right, I want to have this style start at the tablet width, and then I want it to end at the desktop width, or I want it to start at the tablet width and go all the way up the size tree. So really building those utilities and having a utility-based approach first makes our life 10 times easier when we actually go to implement the design system or go to implement any sort of styles across the board.
So in terms of the overall effort then, how might we do it differently in 2020? Like, what were some things that we might take advantage of or might not if we had to do something like this all over again? Not that it's a critique of the project, but how do we improve our tooling and knowledge for the next push?
I guess from the React implementation and the style side, Matt and I have really hardened our sort of approach and ideas around TypeSafe design systems. We're calling it, never mind. but yeah, I think with a lot of the, because we were building this idea as we were actually working on the project, and now that we have a lot more insight, we would know exactly how to architect our application, and it probably would save us some time. You know, we'd have it a little bit more documented.
Yeah, I think on the, you know, on the server side with Node, you know, there's lessons learned every time. You know, you always want to re-implement everything you do after you finish it, because you learn things along the way. That's kind of just, you know, how life goes. That abstraction had worked really well. I think they're still using it. One of the challenges with Node is that, you know, even with TypeScript on top, you know, you're in JavaScript land. So when you want to really button things up and be super tight about an API's design, it's kind of, you have to build your own abstractions. So, you know, next time we will have those abstractions there. And it would be pretty much easier to just drop them in. One thing that we did at this client that I think was a good decision was we did not roll our own table data abstraction. So there was a particular component that was like, you know, you're showing massive amounts of records and you want like super fancy Excel, like kind of like expand and collapse of rows and sort by all kinds of different columns and grouping. And there are lots of statistics and kind of little metrics embedded into every row, you know, and at one point we were at the point where we said, should we roll our own? And I do think that when you have time, you should roll your own most of the time. I think Drew always makes a good analogy is that, like, you know, you can drive your kid to school in a Ferrari, but if your Ferrari breaks down and you don't know how to fix it, you're going to be a lot happier if you would have just, like, you know, rode a bike, because when the chain falls off, you can just, you know, fix the chain. In the case of the table, though, that's the opposite of that, because in the end, some of the virtualization they needed, like, if we had attempted to roll our own table solution, we would have blown the project budget, right?
Yeah.
I hope we made good decisions there in terms of rolling our own design system, but not rolling our own table implementation. And every one of those decisions has to be made on a one-by-one basis. Every project, you learn, like, there's probably something out of the box. Like, I can use it, but I may end up hacking it to a certain extent to satisfy my requirements. Or I can roll my own, and it'll satisfy all my requirements, but it's going to take up time and budget. And I think the constricted time horizon of that project really taught us a lot about how to, like, think hard about those decisions, and then, like, taught us about how those decisions impact a project over the medium to long term. So
Yeah, and as a pattern for Chariot, that's pretty much on target with how we do approach everything. We try to be pragmatic. We try to, if there is something that really does save us time, like you wouldn't build your own express from scratch, right?
Exactly.
So like we don't do that. We don't do crazy talk, but where it's like the graphs were very well defined about what they wanted. I think they were circumscribed enough that someone could have taken that on, like Drew could have taken that on, given enough time horizon. Especially if we had him for the first 2 months of the project, that could have been something to do.
Yeah.
And it's just an interesting angle, you know?
You know, I think I'd like to just to add, because you reminded me, and this really speaks to the design portion of the project. I think it's important to highlight that we did a lot of upfront evaluation of basically data visualization libraries, because in our initial kind of requirements exercise, we thought that this was going to be like a data visualization heavy as a crazy graph that did all kinds of crazy things. When the design team finally got through their exercise, we realized that it was this table library that needed a lot of work, and that the data visualizations that we needed to present, at least for V1, were quite simple. So it could have saved us some time. You know, one of the things I think we're going to try to get better at is like how we integrate the design team into the project and in what order things happen. You know, again, you learn something on every project. I think one thing that we could have done better is we could have gotten those design decisions made a little bit more upfront, so that we didn't spend too much time kind of evaluating something that wasn't as critical as we thought it was.
I think also some of that is just, I wouldn't even say that's a failing. I think that's more of a, we didn't know until we found out what it was. You know, we really started digging through. I think that was a valid exercise. Yeah, I don't even know if it's really more lessons learned than like what we do differently, more than anything else.
I think one thing that we probably maybe should have done, or you know, maybe probably next time, but is if a client is looking for a node backend, I think we should definitely consider using Apollo Server and
GraphQL. That was an original recommendation on the project that got unfortunately nixed because there was a lot of fear about it, and it was so new that year in terms of adoption that I think it was probably valid for them to push back on that too. But go ahead, go down your thought process with that.
So Apollo does a really nice job of giving you the tools that you need to really get started with GraphQL very, very fast. And then a lot of the trends that we've been seeing recently is code first schemas. So actually creating your schema via code. I think that's pretty good. It's very self-explanatory. It's very, it's really well documented. And then another thing is that if a client is, you know, scared of actually going down the GraphQL route, it's really nice to know that Apollo Server hooks directly into Express. So, you know, if there is any uncertainty about a lot of the things that go with GraphQL, it's really not too much of an overhead as far as learning it, but it is built on Express. You can use a lot of the same methods, a lot of the same middleware schemes. You can use a lot of the same notation like app.use, app.router, so on and so forth. So it's a really good solution on the server side, just for, you know, interfacing, just general node strategies. But also on the client side too, is that you can pretty much pick what data you want coming back. And then you also get caching out of the box using the Apollo cache. You don't have to worry about a state management library. And I think that kind of would have helped a little bit as far as our loading states and some of our, we tried to get to a point of where we're doing, you know, true optimistic rendering, but just from the round trip, we wanted to, and also the time crunch, we had to make some concessions. But if we had a out-of-the-box state management library that Apollo client actually has, I think it would have been, done wonders for us.
Yeah, it had that upfrontness that was like potentially very daunting at first. But I think that having a queryable library where you can ask questions like that, if you build the things that you hook into the GraphQL schemas so that you can do those kind of what if kind of queries, would make all the graphing and all that very, very much simpler. So that's fair. I'm going to do my little plug here while we're at it. So I have a talk coming up at Philly Emerging Technologies Enterprise called Serverless Schmerverless, Why Should I Care? And the reason I did that tongue in cheek is because I personally am wrestling with, you know, the Dockerized container way of deploying in a cloud environment versus a native, true native cloud environment where it's Lambdas running functions directly against the cloud. So the talk I'm putting together is really going to kind of try to wrestle that head on and say, okay, you could build something in an EC2 instance. You could build something in Docker. You can make it a little more cloud neutral, which is kind of how our code could have run on something else. Mm-hmm. We just need a Postgres database, you know, and an authentication server, and it could have run anywhere really. Versus like truly scaling something to run in the cloud, where if you're not doing anything with it, it's not costing you any money. And like, what do those things mean? So that's the talk that I'm giving. You know, we could have done this serverless. We pushed on serverless because at the time, the latency. So you've got a React app with lots of graphs and quick rendering of tables. You press a button, it should be very instantaneous to the customer that you get an answer back that you can make decisions on. At the time in April, May, June of 2019, serverless startups could be 10, 12, 13, 14 seconds to wake up a serverless service.
So the other important thing to note there, and I think this is an important point about how you evaluate whether to go full serverless using Lambda or running things in a container, is that you have to consider access patterns. So this particular application wasn't the type of application that someone was going to log into once and then be like using all day for 8 hours straight, where like it's okay if the cold start is a few seconds, because then their experience is going to be real snappy and they're going to be hitting those Lambdas left and right. This is the type of application that like someone comes in the morning and they log in once. They might use it every day, but they're only going to use it for a couple of minutes. So the impression they're going to get, if they only use it for a couple of minutes, is they're going to remember that super slow startup time every single time.
Really good point.
As opposed to something that, you know, that like is just always going to snap. And, you know, hopefully the cloud providers are able to solve those cold start problems soon, because from a cost perspective and from a scaling perspective, those, you know, Lambda and things like that are really great. So hopefully someday we'll be making those decisions differently.
Yeah. My goal in that talk actually is to try to wrestle that and say, here's where we are now. Cause I know Amazon has done a lot to optimize the cold start problem, really sped tons of things up. The question is it really a viable thing? And what does it do to your code? What does your code look like?
And there's a motivation, you know, from the client to run things in Lambda. I think the other thing to think about when, and these are the conversations that we had, is that this application was not going to be terribly expensive to run, even if it did run in EC2 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In fact, I would render to guess that it's probably a fraction of their cloud costs compared to all the other things that they're doing on the IoT side in AWS. Sure. So you pay a certain penalty for the complexity of Lambda. And again, like I mentioned before, we wanted it to be dead simple up front. So that's where that motivation came from.
Yeah, totally agree. You know, in terms of being able to tow into a cloud environment, you know, I personally think that the Docker approach is a nice start. You have the automatically running containers. You can scale them up and down with an auto scaler and a load balancer. You know, it's a good way of doing it so that also your desktop has the same platform. To me, the biggest problem with serverless is to emulate the back end of serverless, you have to do all sorts of crazy things.
A whole nother architecture problem.
It really is.
Go Cloudflare.
You know, a whole nother set of tools in order to do that.
Or go Cloudflare, which is another thing we'll briefly mention when we're doing it, because I know Drew's looking at Cloudflare as a back end to the serverless framework. All right, guys, this has been a fantastic talk. I really appreciate you guys spending a little of your busy schedules on your projects that you're working on, talking about what we did last year. And thanks a lot. And hopefully,
it was a fun project.
Yeah, it was
a fun project.
Great project, yeah. But anyway, I do appreciate it, and hopefully people will see us at ETE and learn some stuff from us.
Yeah, come see our talk.
Yeah, yep. We'll see you there.
All right, guys, thanks so much.
See you guys. See you.
Thanks again to Drew DeCarme and Matt Gilbride for joining us on the TechCast. For show notes, visit us at chariotsolutions.com/techcast. This is episode number 117. You can send us feedback via Twitter at TechCast or via email at techcastfeedback@chariotsolutions.com. Thanks again for listening to the TechCast, hosted by Ken Ridbull and produced by myself, Becca Rufford. Until next time.